Okay. Is there any question or one from your side? I don't see. There's a hand.
Last time you spoke, I don't know if I understood right, but you spoke about in this Vedic philosophy that there is some sort of a will that realizes itself throughout history. The will. You spoke earlier, the example of the giraffe that's neck. Yeah. And I was wondering if in this philosophy there was a concept of matter too, or is it just I have a difficulty with this example you took because it's scientifically not true now. And so I wondered if you could elaborate.
So shortly I can respond. So one thing is that, this is probably when I take pick up Schopenhauer, yeah, and his way of reading ancient Indian philosophies. And in a certain way, you have the same terminology with Kant and with German idealism. They would say that the will is the possibility of self-objectivation, Selbstobjektivierung, as they say. And this is very important because you have this with all German idealists, for example. They would say, if you see something like a will, especially Fichte that makes it strong, he would say that what is the heart in a certain way of will and willing, that it has the capacity of self-positing. This is very important, otherwise you could not think of the new, the modern term of freedom, which we have right now, because insofar as you are able to will, you are not subjected to the objective world, but you have the capacity to produce objectivity in a certain way. This is the very new way of understanding freedom in German idealism and by the way, in modernity, by saying the will is self-positive, which then in 20th century, in the realm of language philosophy, is often expressed in the word performative speech acts. Yeah? So in a way, the speech act, and we have this very strongly today, so with telling somebody, you are not just describing objectively the world, but there is an interest, a self-positive force behind that. This is what we have all the day today between the differentiation between descriptive objective and the way of self-positive. So when I say sentences like the most famous is like Austin in relation to that, Wittgenstein is using in How to Do Things with Words, which would mean that when we have certain speech acts, we are not just describing an objective real circumstances, but we are producing these circumstances. So Austin, for example, has a famous example of when the priest says, herewith I say that you are married, this is not a description of the world. This is not objective. But that speech act does produce the fact that you are married. It's not a fact before the priest is not saying who has authority in certain societies. Today, obviously, it's the state where you have to go and where the state signs in a certain way. He's creating a fact. He's creating the fact that you are married. And it is creation through this performative situation, which is Aristotle already has this distinction. This is not just Austin and late Wittgenstein, but even Aristotle takes the example of a prayer is par excellence a performative reaction. It's not saying, oh, in fact, I am relating to a God, but in a certain way, that relation, that prayer is producing reality. It's not there before the prayer is taking place. And that's exactly what in language is called performative, and what in the same, a certain way, in before 20th century language philosophy would have been called the self-positive aspect of the will. So the will in a certain way is never a fact. This is even in Kant. So the intelligible character you are performing by performing three acts. So the three acts are not given from the gene, it is not given from the milieu, but it is the self-positing force, Shakti, that is taking place in yourself. And this is what, again, Schopenhauer and German idealism would say, the will is never an objective fact, but it is the fact of the capacity of self-objectivation. So it makes and creates something when it performs itself. And it is not just objectively defining a thing. And this is, by the way, very strong. If you read Derrida and all the post-structuralist philosophers, they would claim exactly that there is, it's impossible. And Nietzsche, of course, was probably the first, strongest, that this is an illusion that you think science will tell you the objective world. This is a very old-fashioned term of science, because that would mean, so you have said the thing, so why do science need propaganda or want to sell their theories? So in the very moment they are starting to sell, but what is the theory which you do not sell in a journal? Even in Anglo-Saxon Germans you have to pay. They are very rich, these Germans. So it's business. So if science would just be real without having to be mediated by all these forces, then in a certain way it would be self-positive. But in the very moment, these objectivations have to run through these tests and certification of objectivation. So almost every serious philosopher of science in 20th century would have shared what I'm saying right now. So we went through all this deconstruction of natural sciences. So I'll claim one more example, which probably became very, this is why if you read Karambara, yeah, quantum physicists, you will say, okay, there is no natural science without social circumstances. Marx was alluding, he was very fond of science, but Marx would say you cannot take natural science theories without not relating to the power constellation of the social milieu in which they are generated. So there is not natural science, and there are soft sciences like humanities, but the humanities, as Barat would say, for example, are always interacting with the natural science. You never have pure natural science, and this is always what we have today all the time. Think of Corona and all these things where we have strong social opinions interconnected with natural science opinions. Or think of Fridays of Future, yeah, where in a certain way a strong propaganda is connected with scientific theory. So we have to make these scientists act and be accepted, for example, they would say, in the social circumstances, people in the social frame has to accept it. So this is not just objectives, on a lot of performative switches which you have. You want to make people accept the natural science theories on. But is this now natural that people accept this? Or is this social? If it is social, You are producing in a certain way objectivity, and you are not just telling something objective. So the last example probably bringing in Judith Butler, who was so important for my education, and I was in New York. I was studying in the whole setting of Derrida and of Judith Butler and Ali Tal and all this. So the feminist thinkers were strongly saying that, you know, you cannot reduce natural science to the facts. Because if you, for example, would have counted how many women were in the 19th century said to stay at home, you would have all over the globe a big majority, also in Europe, not just in Africa. So the natural fact of counting, for example, in statistics, how many women are said to stay at home and watch for the people and cook in a certain way, this is not just a fact. Of course, it was a fact. But in order to change that fact, you need performative speeches who are resisting that discourse that says women have to stay at home and cook. So is this now natural science or not? No, this is where the social, in a certain way, counteracts sometimes to the facts that you have in a certain society. And whole critical theory, Adorno and everybody, is exactly saying that when you want to have resistance, that resistance is not just a fact, but that is something you have to perform. So it's something that wants to create facts and not just be in affinity with the facts. This is a very strange for somebody like me. When I was a student like you, you know, facts had not a big credibility when I was there. Because it was always that it's clear that facts are produced. And so they have a performative dimension. Or like in the 19th century would have said, the will power in yourself is not subjected to the facts, but produces facts. That's exactly the capacity of your will. That you are not, the will is never just objectively here. But I have to go now to the next thing. So that would be my answer to these things. Yeah? And in a certain way, the whole mantric idea, to come back to India, is very much a mantra. It's not just describing the world, but it is performance. It is calling something into being. And that is the very, very power, as Aristotle would say. This is the real power of language, that it does not just describe reality, but language and just look into the world in which, where we have all the discourses which want to produce us and our needs. This is the whole of Foucault. So Foucault, you cannot understand Foucault, you cannot understand critical theory, you cannot understand deconstructionism, you cannot understand feminist philosophy if you just think that this is all about facts. This is much more about using, creating through language something different to what is factually given. If feminists would just follow, have to follow, they said it would still be at the kitchen. But they had to resist, they had to work with the performative power of language. In a certain way, in India, you would say they were going to the marketing class. They understand that language has a performative, creative dimension. And this creative dimension has to be performed. It's waiting for us to be performed. Otherwise, we are just objectively given beings. But we don't accept
the self-positing power in ourselves. All the political terms of modernity have to do with the performative power. That we are autonomous, that we can create. All these modern ideas of the whole political frame are very strongly bound to these ideas of a self-positing, self-governing will. And that will is not factual, but it is creative. In Kant, you have this very strongly, and yeah, all this. So that would be my short bits. Okay, so I go now to the last things which we had here. Just to repeat today, I will really quickly end with this folder. So we have here to remember that we have the darkness in the darkness, then we had the idea that a non-existence is more real. That's exactly what we are speaking about. So what is not yet existing is more real than the facts which do exist. This was something which was here. And then Aurobindo, in his interpretation, this is not in the original hymn. He also distinguishes then already in sight of his own philosophy, that where they say the desire is the seed of mind, of the mental, he would say, distinguish here the first wake desire, which we have alluded to, the blind desire of, for example, again, Schopenhauer. Yeah, so we are not starting like Kant from desire and will to be something consciously taken, but there is a will that is blind in us. And I said, I like Spinoza's triad here, where he, in the Latin language, I think it's very telling, they say, so the blind will in our body is the conatus on the level of the appetitus. Yeah? So this is the appetite in us. And this is usually translated as what Freud then calls strifes. Yeah? The A's dimension. It makes me hungry. It makes me thirsty. It makes me. Yeah? It's not that I'm doing it. I don't experience it that I am doing the digestion of my food, but it digests my food. So this is appetitus. Then we have cupiditas, which is the sensing of these processes. So we have, we suddenly have a certain feeling, a sensitivity, cupiditas toward these processes. And then the third step is what Kant begins in a certain way, then is the voluntary, voluntas, yeah, the voluntary act. So Aurobindo here has something similar where he says this is the first wake desire, which in Latin would be appetitus. Yeah? So just desire something or have a demand, a drive in a certain way. And then this is a merely vital movement, and then in a certain way, as an adushit, as we will see, it will create the mental sheet in the human being, which is supposition, superposition, a certain way of this vital thing, where we then have the mental sphere that is evolving out of this time. So that was important, that it's not the reflection of our mental being is objective again, but it is in itself the development of a drive. Something is driving nature to develop something like the brain and to develop mental sphere. Schopenhauer again, by reading Indian philosophy, calls it so the desires put on a light, says Schopenhauer. So they switch on a light, which is then the mind, the mental mind. So the mental mind, not as an opposition to our appetite and to our desires, but as a way of turning on a light, which now allows them to consciously follow their drives and fulfill their wishes in a certain way. Yeah? So that was this, and to create. And then the last sentence, this is now why I wanted to repeat this, I read it, quote, "The conscious existence which they thus create is stretched out, as it were, horizontally between two other extensions." This will be very important for my first understanding of this world in which they are. So he now says, so all these desires, this appetite, these vital desires and mental desire are, as the seers and poets experience themselves, so the Kalis and the Rishis, they experience now that all these realms we spoke about, so nutrition, appetite, kubiditas, the vital desires, manas, the mental desires, are in between, horizontally, two oceans. Yeah? That is the thing, the consciousness thing which is us create, stretched out, as it were, horizontally, between two other extensions. Below is the dark sleep of the subconscious. Yeah? So they say now, deeper than your mind, deeper than your desires, deeper than your appetite in your body, there is a lake, there is an ocean, the ocean of the subconscious that is even deeper, as Nietzsche once said, deeper as daylight. Yeah? So it's deeper than the light of day ever reached. So there is a subconscious subconscious ocean at the ground. The Arche, Greek, or the principle, as we have it today already. And so the ground, at the ground, there is the subconscious ocean. And from there, they see that the appetites, the vital, the mental, have evolved in a certain way. Yeah? And now, this is not the whole of the story, but below is the dark sleep of the subconscious. Of course, we had this also as the state of deep sleep. Yeah, this will come, especially by the tantric. So this subconscious, we, in a certain way, have an experience, which is almost a non-experience, by falling into deep sleep. There, we are on this level of consciousness, and we say, this is technically currently in many Indian traditions to be the seat of the heart. Yeah. So there in the subconscious is the seat of the heart. But the end of the story above is the luminous secrecy of the superconscious. These are the upper and the lower ocean. So that's not just for these Kavis and seers were there and they, by research into their heart, it is said, they found out these levels of the subconscious, the earth, the nutrition sheet, the vital sheet, the mental sheet, and there was something above. So there was something above the upper ocean, and there was something below. Our window interprets now, below is the ocean of the subconscious, and the vast distortion of the overconscious. Yeah, something that is luminous. Yeah? It's like, in a certain way, like a heaven of consciousness, something like this. Yeah? And they were astonished now by these Kavis, these poets and seers, by detecting all these different realms themselves. So intuitive. They saw and experienced this themselves. So this is this Vedic hymn in the oldest of the Vedas, in the Rig Veda. And so a little bit I made my very fantastic paintings and illustrations. I think this is quite clear. Just to introduce some words. So obviously they are standing here, these Kavis and Rishis in the middle, and it's called also the middle world. So there is an upper world, a lower world, and the middle world. Yeah? It is the threefold world in the Veda. And so you have this upper luminous ocean of of superconscient, you have here the lower ocean of the subconscious, which in Chamkhya Yoga, for example, is called Mula Prakriti, in Tantric Swama Kundalini. So you have here this ocean, and in between, the whole cosmos in a certain way pops up. All the beings pop up. I have made one more distinction here, which is very important in terms of the Mula Prakriti, of this first potential matter, which is in the subconscious, yeah, where everything is involved in a certain way. The whole becoming is involved here. So it's only here involved matter or potential matter. The Wurzel Materie in German, Mula is the root, and Prakriti is to really translate, but let's say material nature, but this is still a formless virtual matter, form of matter. It's Mula Prakriti, and so what is special about this lower ocean? We say out of it arise Udaya. Out of it arise in a certain way the beings. So whatever we see here as beings has developed out of this ocean of the subconscious. So that all beings are now grown out here, like this middle axis here. They are grown out of this. So they develop, entwickeln. This is really a Sanskrit root word, German. So it is entwickeln, the Kundalini. So it is like a sutra, like a string. Yeah? And so there is a distinction in the Mula Prakriti between those realms which have already developed, which would be here the full line, and then there is here still circles which have not yet been developed. Yeah? And these are the words avyakta and vyakta. Vyakta means those levels of the Mula Prakriti which have already been developed, became manifest, and avyakta, those which are still sleeping here in the Kundalini, in the involved matter, and they are still here and waiting to be awakened. So if you go up here, you will awake more circles in the Mula Prakriti. Is this understandable? Yeah? So if this goes here up, then in a certain way, something will come here down and you awake circles which have not yet been evolved from the Mula Prakriti. Yeah? So they are still silently in the background of you. Yeah, they still sleep there. They still sleep there, and in order to grow on the vertical side into the high, you have to awake sleeping potentials in your Mula Prakriti. And if you awake them, you will grow, you will develop higher. Yeah? So that is the logic in a certain way. So the higher you develop, the more potential from the Mula Prakriti, from the first matter, as Aristotle said, from Kora, as Plato says, is evolved and developed. Yeah, so this is this, then the second thing, which where it becomes a little bit more complicated. So we have again the lower ocean here, as we saw it, we have the upper ocean there, yeah? And now we have two axes. We have, in a certain way, an axis of Entwicklung. And this is really the Sanskrit word, development, Entwicklung. So it's like from the Mula Prakriti, like a string is unfolding, yeah? From the Mula Prakriti, and it's going higher and higher. So that is this ascent. It is the evolution. Aurobindo would really call it. It's the direction of the evolving, of the involved matter. And there, in a certain way, whenever you go up, something is coming down from the upper ocean, which would be, in Aurobindo's term, the descent of the spirit. So you have an upper axis and you have a down axis, and as Heraclitus says, the road up is the same as the road down. Yeah? The famous sentence fragment from Heraclitus, and it really perfectly fits also to this ocean. This, I have here two lines, but in a certain way they can combine. And then you are going up and you are going down in the way in contact between the upper and the ocean, lower ocean. And now one theory which I wanted to, in order to finish these first things, but in order to give you an idea of how the cosmos was looking for these people. Now, this is not just that evolution in a certain way more and more develops the lower ocean, and when it develops, beings are coming into being which have a certain step or plane of evolution. So exactly as the German language says, Entwicklungsstufe. Yeah? So we have exactly here the Sanskrit idea. Yeah? So, in a certain way, there are certain beings popping up out of the primordial matter, as Aristotle would call it, this ocean here, so the formless matter. So you have a lot of beings who in the cosmos now start to pop up on certain levels of development. Yeah? And these levels of development is usually, this is the Panchakosha theory, the theory of the five bodies or the five planes, in a certain way, where you have, so evolution first develops certain space, certain planes. Yeah? So before a body comes, that comes as spheric plane, yeah? In a certain way, a kosha. Yeah? And the first sphere which evolves in the evolution of the cosmos is the so-called Ananaya Kosha, which is the physical sphere, the sphere of gross bodies. Yeah? So when the planets on the sky come into being, they are gross matter. Yeah? So they are not the Mula Prakriti. They are not the subconscious ocean, which not yet has a form, but is potential matter. But now, as Aristotle and Greek philosophy would say, this potential matter takes shape and appears on the physical level, for example, as a generation of planets. So in a certain way, this is a big difference. In Aristotle, it's not clear whether the planets are eternal. But here it's very clear they have strong evolutionary theory, yeah? And they would say, no, the planets which we see here, they have not existed eternally. They have been generated when the first sheet of being, the physical sheet, Uranus, the heaven, is already a product of the first sheet of the coming into being of the physical space. The physical field, the physical plane, however you want to translate kosha. So there are the particles, the planets, all gross matter is coming first here. This is the first space, the first field, the first plane that comes into being, gross matter. It's also connected strongly then to the earth and to food. Now, as we said, the appetite. Yeah? So, saying these gross bodies are not just mechanical, but in a spinozist way, they have conatus. They are driven. Yeah? The planets are driven.
you will not see, when you see the planets, it's not just an objective body with a certain meaning, but that body already is the objectivation of the physical drive. Yeah? And that drive or that meaning for them has especially the quality of tamas, which is the quality of gravity. So what makes objects like planets to behave almost like mechanical is not because they are just mechanical, but they are in a certain way in the grip of the hand of tamas of gravity. And this makes all physical bodies behave in accordance to the principle of gravity, which means that they are not very dynamic. they are very dynamic if you look on the big scene of how they circulate and rotate in the universe, but in a certain way they are not dynamic in the way that they quickly change their attributes. They are massive, they have certain stable attributes. As we know from quantum physics, particles on a very small scale do not have physics attributes. Now, if you go to big, massive bodies like planets, they look like being just mechanical because they behave according to being in the grip of the hand of tamas of gravity. But if you go, for example, on small scales, you will see that you have freaky particles who have no stable attributes, but only, as you know today, when they are collapsing in a certain way, then they have stable attributes, but before, very basically, they don't have these stable attributes. And all physicians on this globe are now thinking and creating a lot of theories how this can be, that matter on a small scale does not behave like a chair, because these chairs are gross bodies, and this means they are quite stable. They are in the grip of the hand of their gravity system. That means these chairs, when I come into this room, I can tell you that I am quite sure that next week they will behave quite similar in this week. So they have more or less stable thing, they are not just walking out of the room. They're like these crazy small particles of matter too, yeah, which show these spooky attributes, but they are quite gross stable bodies, and therefore they look like being mechanical. Yeah? They look like being mechanical because they behave more or less tamasic in a constant way. Yeah, and on the human body, this is strongly connected to your Unterleib. What is English word for Unterleib? The womb.
That's
even. Yeah, that's only. As I was saying, it's in this bodily region. Yeah, here. Usually, so there you have this tamas, these things are working, this part of your body is working strongly subjective to the principle of gravity. Yeah? This is why I, in a certain way, always say, I can say, I think I said it once, please stop breathing for the next 5 seconds. I think most of you have no problem to do this, but when I say, please stop digesting for the next 5 seconds, I think most of us have a problem. This is tamas, yeah? So this is it, does it for us. Yeah? Reason I can, in a certain way, start to interact with my voice. Yeah? I can, in a certain way, control it. Yeah? But it's very difficult to control what is here. So we have more the feeling that it drives us to digest, yeah, something, and it's not something we can consciously control. So this would be the first plane. But in the evolution, and then you can say all grow bodies who are born in this cosmos have the, I would call it the field attribute of being, having the attribute of being of gravity. Yeah? So whenever one body does appear on a physical plane, it has the quality of having a certain mass. So of course planets are real big mass, gross bodies, they have big mass, and but also these things which are in this room or my body has compared to small scale bodies have strong mass. So they are massive, they are solid, they are behaving more or less in a mechanical Tamasic matter. So this is the physical, but then they would say, oh no, this is only the first sheet that has involved in the evolution of beings. So the next sheet that in a certain way superposes, which it's, you know, a sheet for them is a little bit what we in contemporary physics or natural science would call a phi. Yeah? It's an attribute which has a whole space. So gravity is not something I own in this room. It's also not that one of your bodies does own gravity, but it's the other way. Yeah? This is very difficult for us being Europeans and thinking that everything is grounded in an individual. No, this is why we use the word space in this room. So the whole space here has the attribute of gravity. And all the bodies in the space share this attribute. So every single particle in this body has a certain form of mass, but the gravity is not a particle, but it's a field. It's a space in a certain way. Yeah? And so that field of gravity or space of gravity or plane of gravity, everything is legitimate to translate. So when I speak now, there is a vital plane for them. It is the opening of a new space in space. Yeah, we could probably say this is only a theory now, but we could say this is a space with a new spectrum. Yeah, so spectrum was very important, especially for my generation. So in avant-garde music, it is often called spectral music. Yeah, so. So light has a certain spectrum, sound has a certain spectrum, yeah, and so and they are these now a new spectrum, a new plane of space is growing up. Again, the vital for them is not primarily first, that's my reading. Of course we can discuss it, but it's a plane attribute. That means the vital is not first something that is a property of a special body, but it is a property of a space. Like the quantum or physics would speak of the field theory. Yeah, this is very much, this is a field. The vital is first not a singular body, but it's a field, it's a space. And all the bodies who share this space have the vital attributes in a certain way at their heart. So if I am a vital body, my body shares the common attributes of the vital field. Yeah? And you, if you have a vital body, your body also shares the attribute of the vital field. Yeah, this is a way of thinking. I think modern natural science is very close to these old systems, but it's not how we in daily life think things. We usually think gravity is an attribute of my body. Yeah, so I have a certain weight. But it's not that the space has a weight, or the space gives me a certain weight, because I'm a physical body. And it's not, I have a vitality because I myself have a body that has evolved the vital plane in itself. Do you can follow a little bit how they marry the thing? Yeah? So every vital body in this room participates. This is exactly Plato's work. What is the Greek word for participation? Yes, metexis. So everybody shares the attribute of having a certain weight here, of being part of the vital plane. Yeah? And even as human beings, we have also evolved a part of the mental plane. So we have also a mental atmosphere in this case. But again, they would say the mental is first dispensed. Yeah? It's when the evolution creates a mental space, then bodies can appear which have the attributes of that space. Yeah? So like there is a mental field, and since we all have mental bodies, it means that our bodies have evolved the principle of the mental plane, body. And therefore, with our mental bodies, and vital bodies and physical bodies, we can perform mental actions. You understand? So we can only in the modern sense be a subject that can think, a subject that has desires, because my body has evolved. This is their idea of evolution. Very different. But I think philosophically it's still highly interesting that they would say, okay, first the space of the mental sphere is formed, and when the human beings evolve on the earth, bodies were created that participated, metaxis, Plato, on this mental field. That they created body, which in a certain way now were able to bodily act on this plane. Yeah? If I don't have a mental body, I cannot act actively on this. So an animal that has not developed the mental sphere has the sphere here. So the animal that was, this would be an animal. Yeah? Or yeah, this would be an animal that is already starting to enter the mental sphere. Yeah? This would be the human animal. Yeah, I come to this. This would be just a gross body with no vital plane because it ends here. Yeah, I think this is quite neat. So these are different developments of Entwicklungsstufen, of planes of Entwicklung. So everybody you see here below this is just a physical, but these bodies are just part, metaxis, participating on the physical. Bodies who grow from the physical into the vital now have also unfolded, evolved, bodily, an active vital sphere, so they can desire. And if they go to the next sphere, they can also think in a certain way we understand this. Yeah? There was a question, I see somebody. Sorry. Yes, very good question. This is exactly the Mula Prakriti or the Vama Kundalini concept of the tantrics. Whatever erects, so the tantric would call this a Kini, Kundalini, so whatever erects in the vertical direction, in the evolution, and the unfolding of the evolution, so the human being has erected up to this mental plane in a certain way. So whatever erects has been laid, where has it been before it was erected? So what would be your answer according to their system? Where has it been before it has been erected? Before human beings started to appear on the earth. Yes, and in which part of the consciousness? The subconscious. Yeah? You wanted to say something?
I thought maybe on the bottom of the ocean?
Yes, exactly, the subconscious. So they all
Udaya, they all arise from the ocean of the subconscious. Evolution is an upwards movement, as they would say, in which what is involved here in the Mula Prakriti, in the ocean, is evolving. Yeah? So, in a certain way, the human is, when here I would have to, I cannot do it. So, these parts of the Mula Kundalini are probably now evolved in the physical. So the next rounds of the Mula Prakriti are evolved in the animal. The next is evolved here in the human. So when something is evolving, a next sheet of the Mula Prakriti is erected. Yeah, it's becoming vertical. And first it's horizontal. Yeah? If you remember, it's a horizontal. So there was something laying down, like the Mula Prakriti, and there was something above. It was also horizontal, it was like a field more, so not the body, but the field. And then, now more and more layers that were laying in the subconscious, in the Mula Prakriti, in the first matter, have been evolved. So first physical sheet, which is the inner circle of the Mula Prakriti. Next, the vital field, which is the next circle that is in the Mula Prakriti. Then, from here, from the Mula Prakriti, there is the Mahamaya, which is the next circle here. There is the Vijnanamaya, there is the Anandamaya, and the Sakshitamaya. Yeah? So they are all there already in the matter, but they are virtual, potential, not evolved. They are involved. Yeah? So when you have evolution, they always would see it as a counter to evolution. So in your primal matter, everything that will erect is already potentially there, but in an unactivated, simply virtual man. And when you evolve something, so when physical bodies evolve, so they appear in space. When vital bodies evolve, so plants and animals appear in space. When the mental sphere evolves, the human bodies will be in space. Yeah? And always when they evolve, it means for them something that first was sleeping, think of deep sleep, something that was deep sleeping in your Mula Prakriti is now erected, animated, and starts to evolve. It's now active. As long as it is sleeping in the Mula Prakriti, it is for you as if it would not exist. This is the word ego. Yeah? Which is an almost ever important definition of a term. You find this strange word Eva, which means we or als ob. Yeah? So, when something is not animated here, yeah, when it's still here in the Mula Prakriti, and it's not yet animated, so it is not yet erected here, when it is still here, it is silent, Eva, as it could not. Yeah? Only what has been erected is for you and on the side of being. And this, what is not erected, is on the side of non-being. Because you cannot actively experience. So if a human cannot actively experience all human being, or it evolves that pain itself. If it starts to evolve that pain, of course the human starts to get in touch with the old problems. Yeah? But as long as you are not at all, your appetite is not at all interested in the old human, but you are just interested in human being, the old human does not exist. They would say, yes, you are absolutely alive, otherwise you would lie. It would be absolutely a lie if you believe in all humans, if you have not developed an old human plane. So if people say, I have no idea of God or a whole human being,
this system would say, yes, that you're absolutely right, because you have animated these planes, and you have not animated any plane that is beyond the human. As long as you have not animated a plane that is beyond the human, and you speak the truth, you have to say, it is as if there would exist Eva, as if there would exist no human, no other human being. I have never met somebody or something other. And they would say, okay, so that's absolutely okay, but that just shows that you are not interested in planes who are beyond the human being. Right? So that's okay as long as you don't make yourself the ruler of the cosmos and blame people who have access to a human being that they are stupid or they should go into psychiatry or these kind of things. In that very moment they would say, oh, that's not right what you are doing right now, because you have no access to a human being, you think nobody else should have access to you. So if you sent them in psychiatry, they would say, and that's really fact, so psychiatry is very differently handled in Asian culture than in. So we usually bring them, as Foucault would say, into a separated space. So they have to be separated from us who have not this strange being. But in a certain way, many other cultures, not just India, were treating these people very differently, not just of separation, but it was accepted that they have experiences which others do not have, and so let them live their own experiences in a certain way. So this is not just theoretical, but as Foucault says, how we handle with people who believe that there is something above the human, they would say, yes, it's absolutely correct if you say, I am not interested or I have no idea of these things. But if you start to universalize and make it normative, you create a problem. Because you make, as Protagoras in the West said, you make your own experience of consciousness the only one. Yeah, that has the criterion of judging all the other forms of development. So these models are not just theoretical, but they have very strong political and social consequences. Yeah? So from this model, you can clearly say, okay, somebody who says, I don't know, he's a human, he has developed the mental, the vital, and the physical plane, and he says, I have no idea and no experience that there is a fourth and fifth dimension. Yeah, so that there are certain like this here, this being has is overhuman for them because it has developed not just the physical, vital, mental, but also the gnostic and already a little bit of the blissful and the causal body. Yeah. And for them, I guess, it is therefore no problem that these beings do exist and should be allowed to exist in consciousness, yeah? In a certain way. The problem is when one of these beings make, so they would say with Protagoras, yeah, such a being like this here, if it could speak, it would say, oh, no plants, no animals, no human beings can exist. It's impossible, yeah? So the particles would say, impossible, I cannot, I am so in the grip of gravity, no other being can get out of this tamasic plane. And they would say, yes, it's absolutely correct, this is how the world looks if you are a particle here. Yeah? And if you, a plant would say here, oh, I don't believe that something like human evolution would ever be possible in this cosmos, then they would say, okay, that's absolutely correct. This is how you experience from your mental consciousness of the world. But in a certain way, you make yourself the criterion of for everyone. So you start to become a fascist plant in a certain way, who says, I'm the only one, I have to critique
everybody, and in a certain way, I tell you, human evolution is impossible. Yeah, that's in a certain way how it must look from the perspective of this planet here. Yeah? But for this other human being who probably exists, it must look very different. For them, the human, how would it look, the human evolution for them? If you, let's say, okay, let's accept for this model for a moment the system, and here we have so-called, this model says that there are all human beings. How would they experience the evolution of human beings on Earth? So what would be typical things what they probably would say, these beings, these Gnostic beings?
Well, that would kind of depend on if it's within their ability to perceive something other than themselves, or if human beings for them would be transcendent in the sense that they can't really experience them at all.
Yeah, but saying that they can get in touch with human beings and they can in a certain way see the human and it have a share. Yeah, they are on the same. This share would for them be they share the same place. So why can these other human beings see or get in touch with the human? Not because it's a subject or a here a certain human body and another human body, but what do they share?
They share the same basis, so they share all the other
things. Exactly. Places. They share the same cosmos in a certain way, which is the whole system that you have. Yeah? So they share in a certain way all this, that there is a lower ocean, that there are planes. So this is an attribute that is not reserved for one of these bodies, but this is the cosmos, and cosmos is the real Greek word, because cosmos means not just the many, is tapanta, means all the many numerous beings in Greek. But cosmos means the system in which all these human beings live. And so what we share in this room is that with these chairs and with the other human fellows, in a certain way, we share this entire cosmic system. And only because we are in the same cosmic spaces, we can in a certain way be in touch with each other. If you take away all this whole cosmos, cosmic thing, then this human or being could not be in touch with the human or the animal or the plant form. It's only because these bodies do share the same body, as this is called. So they are part, this is exactly, by the way, also what whole Germanics say. So body is usually called translated into reason, and that's the whole point of Kant and Germanism, that they would say reason is not, even Kant would say this. Germanism, Hegel, Schelling, Fichte, of course, but even Kant would exactly claim this, that reason is not a faculty of the human being, but reason is the space in which all beings are, in a way, sharing. So the human have, in a certain way, access to this space. They can reflect this space, and therefore they become reasonable. Yeah? So then the individual body becomes a reasonable body. But of course, for Kant, reason is what they would call also Buddhi, which would be sozusagen the whole space of principles, of tattvas, which we find. So the reason in classical European philosophy is the faculty to understand principles. Yeah? And the principle is not one being, a chair, or a human being,
But the principle is the closure, it's the plane that we commonly share. So there is one reason needs, there is one common place, or there is one common world which we all together share. That's the theory of freeze. And this is very different according to Kant to mind, because mind according to Kant is the understanding of one thing. I understand how the ants work. I understand how the human body works. This is natural science. But natural science is always in a duality of Gegenständigkeit. And reason for Kant exactly is the faculty that tries to systematize all these different beings in order to think the unbedingte zu bedingen, as Kant. So, to think what is the system that in a certain way all these different ways of being do share together, to take the Platonic term of metaphysics. So what is that one thing that all the different beings, from the physical particles to the vital, the mental, the overhuman, what do they commonly share? And the word for this commonly being is in many Indian systems, Buddhi, and translated into German as reason. So reason is trying to think the one in which all the many participate. Yeah? That is reason. Okay, that's the German understanding of reasoning philosophy. And that's quite close to the Indian term of the Buddha. So reasoning in this German analysis would be the Buddha, in a certain way, the one who awakes into the principles of being. So the one who starts to understand the principles of being, and not just the principle of all the being, many beings, who participate in this one principle. That is the old philosophical term of reason. And this is very close to the fourth realm, which is the Gnostic realm of Vijnana Maya. Yeah? This is no more the mental understanding, but this is the understanding of the one in which all the many forms of beings are sharing, participating. And this is also grammatically in language, what is I as a human being participate in the principle of humanity, which is the grammatical form in language that would express this, that I as a human being here participate in the principle of humanity. What is grammatically means?
In German is particip, I don't know English.
Yeah, the particip. This is why in ancient, many ancient languages, you have struck so many participles. This means, if I am very close now, I as a human being be a Menschender. I am a Menschender. Yeah, this would be like old languages would have counted. I am a Lebender. There we can say it. Yeah? So I am a Lebender means that I, as a living being, participate in the principle of life. So the principle of life evolves in my own being. Yeah? And so I am an animation of that principle in one single body. But the principle is more the space which I share with other living beings. So it's the conscious, it's the plane. Deleuze and 20th century philosophy was so always alluding to this difference. And this solves, in a certain way, I would say, this is the answer to Heidegger's question of being. So that's exactly what Heidegger always was looking for, of this ontological difference between being and beings. Yeah?
But I think what Deleuze exactly takes the same words in French philosophy, 20th century, he calls it plane. Yeah? And we have, he says, to distinguish, for example, between a plane and a concept, and so on. I will not go to this. Yeah? So 1, 2, 3, yeah? 4. Oh, sorry, you were first. So 1, 2, 3, 4.
I was wondering if you could also put it the same way in physical terms when we speak of dimensions. For example, that we share 3 dimensions with all the other beings, and a 2-dimensional being would only share the 2 dimensions with us, and the being that would have access to the 4th dimension would have access to 1 dimension more than.
Exactly. So that brings us exactly to old geometry. Yeah, if you read Plato, Timaeus, he's exactly the same. So old geometry was exactly showing, so what is it, how many dimensions does a line have? How many dimensions does a point have? How many dimensions does
a rectangle?
Rectangle, and so on. So if you look into all nature philosophy, it is only about exactly what you are saying. Yeah? So we could also say, so the Mula Prakriti has, in the latest 3 dimensions, I don't want to go to this, and this is the dimensions of the 3 times. So the unfolded, the one that has to be unfolded, this is what I made here with the avyakta and the vyakta. So that which is manifested, which is not yet, which that which is already manifest, that which is not yet manifest, and that which is in the process of manifestation. So these are the 3 dimensions of time in a certain way, and what whole evolution is in the whole system, even in the not yet unfolded. If you look to the human there, I have avyakta and vyakta. Vyakta is all these dimensions, these 3 dimensions are usually developed in a human body, in a human being, but 4 and 5 are usually not manifest and evolved in an ordinary kind of human being. Yeah? And so you have here, this is what you have already become, and above is what you have not yet become. And in a certain way, if you now want to do the difference between what you have become and what you have not become, the existent and the non-existent, which we heard in the thing, then you are in the process of becoming. Yeah. So, probably somebody here in these rooms now would like to start to develop Vijnana Maya and has not yet started Vijnana Maya. So then you have started to become Vijnana Maya in a way of unfolding that pain and evolving it in your own bodily being. Yeah. So you have always these 3 dimensions of the unfolded, the already unfolded, the not yet unfolded, and where you would like to unfold yourself further. Yeah? Which brings you from there into the not yet unfolded, the idiot, the amyat. Yeah? And of course we can find much more dimensions. Yeah? We can say, okay, these are the basic foundations, because all here you can bring together with the 3-fold time, and then you can say, okay, but the planes are also dimensions. So the 3-fold times in this diagram has 5 layers. Yeah? And the 4 and 5 is not yet unfolded. 1, 2, 3 is usually unfolded in human beings. Yeah? And so we have the 4th and 5th dimension not yet unfolded, because it is in the time for us in the future.
in the not yet dimension. So two dimensions would for us be in the future, yeah, 4 and 5, and 3 would be in a certain way in the natura naturata, in the already developed, evolved part of our of the evolution of ourselves. Yeah, so that would be the thing. Yeah, I hope this helps. There were further, yes, you and you and you.
So, if humans are in the third plane, how come we can have an idea with the Veda about the fifth and the fourth?
Why do you think?
And the upper ocean. Because it's supposed that the people who wrote the Veda were in the upper ocean.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they became all human beings, of course. This is exactly very different. You know what I said? In Christianity, to be human means to be taught. Yeah? This is so-called human exceptionalism. What is strongly countered by ecological post-human thinking and all that. So Christian human exceptionalism. So we are always a little bit fascistoid because we think and we are very angry if we believe, especially we Europeans, are very angry if we say that we are not the highest peak of creation. And so that makes us usually very angry. There should be something above us, is something which does create a lot of resistance, especially European beings. Think of Sartre. Sartre said, the human freedom is the belief that there cannot be transcendence. We are not free when a God commands. Yeah. But what would be when I choose by freedom to develop into a gnostic being? What is that would be my free choice as a human being? This is the question I would ask that. So what is when I say by free will, so Christian topos, by free will I would like to become a gnostic being? Is this now command under a higher law? No, I want myself to become Gnostic. So I don't subject myself to a transcendent Christian law, but I in a certain way try to evolve capacities or be forms of being which I have not yet evolved. This is very different. This is not that I'm subjected to another being. So these are planes are not another being. There is no God standing there and commanding me as a human being to, you have to. Oh, this is something that can be decided in a certain way. And they would say exactly to answer your answer, what is called a rishi is somebody, a human being, that developed planes that for most human beings are not developed. So they became extraordinary. So however you would like to call. But it's also not, so the human beings have access to the over human being. This is very ancient thinking. So it's not that this is another being. You know, that's a big difference, one of the biggest differences. To Europe. It's not that even when they, Brahmin would classically say, if people, ordinary people, would pray to a god, they should do it, but they don't know that they pray to themselves. Yeah? So this is not, I subject myself to another being, but it is a form of myself toward which I evolve. So the self is going through all the planes. The Atman is not one of these planes, but it is in a certain way the self. that goes and evolves. Husserl has a nice word. He says, we humans are self-constitutive. Yeah? So, und wir konstituieren uns selbst, wie Husserl sagt. So, the self is a process of becoming in which you evolve yourself. So the self is not just a ready-made thing, but it is something that has to be, as Husserl said, constituted. And in the process of self-constituting, the self is generating in a certain way itself, which brings us closer to what we said at the beginning of the power of the self, positive power of the will. Yeah? And it's you and you.
Yeah, what I'm going to say now may not make sense to what you just said, but I was going to ask, and this is very speculative, but this has been on my mind for years now, which is that could it be that in Western philosophy we've neglected to really conceptualize becoming, werden, in ways that would motivate a belief in these phenomena of evolution that go beyond whichever state of being we have at the present moment? Like, we have more of a tradition that's concerned with being as opposed to non-being, states of being, but not how states of being change. And does not that kind of prejudice or that kind of focus create an attitude that would go like, oh no, 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 this is the state of being, and everything beyond that is just irrational or transcendent, or we can't say anything about it, because we're already not taking evolution, evolving, becoming seriously on already the level of being we're in.
Exactly. But that's exactly what many people then call. So that's exactly what they say, so to say, we have lost transcendence. This is very often very conservative, usually, claim in our society. We have lost transcendence. So I would say, we have to think transcendence, as Georgia Lampen said, as Markus Steinweg says, and many others, I also, that what we call transcendence is for them transimmanence. It's not I transcend myself to an alterity which I am not, but I transcend myself to evolve myself into that, for me now, transcendent state. So I transimmanate. Yeah? This is for me a very important term in order to overcome this state. So if I would say you are believing in a transcendent God, I would be the first who would be highly. Yeah? So you subject yourself to another being. But if you say you affirm transimmanence, you are saying that yourself can evolve in new forms of becoming. You become a person, yeah, who was in a certain way probably one of the strongest atheists in the 20th century. It's his philosophy, because he did not, he said with Spinoza that he is fighting against the concept of transcendence. Yeah? But so for the human here who has evolved this 4 and 5 is in a certain way transcendence, because it is still sleeping here in the Mula Prakriti and has not been awakened. Yeah, in order to arise, Udana, to this level. But this transcendence is on the same time immanent. Because nobody else than I myself become this. Not you, not another being, not the God is becoming this, but it's a way of becoming myself. Or self-realization of myself on the plane that is right now non-existent in myself. This is why the seers and the rishis said that being is grounded in non-being. So the silence which I am not, am I in a certain way more than the one which I am? Yeah? So up to it. It's tricky to say this, but it has a truth for that. That is their claim. So what you are not yet. In Godard, the filmmaker, there is a nice film where he quotes, by the way, also Heidegger, and he says, once they are these bourgeois people are in their beautiful house with the swimming pool and everything around, and then they even speak academically, highly educated on Heidegger, and suddenly one says, an art, the future human being. So that's exactly the thing. So of course these fish and all these things, out of them evolutionarily we have, the human being has not been created out of nothingness, but it has evolved out of beings which were not human. Yeah? So the non-human creatures are the birthplace for the human creature. Yeah? In a certain way. So they are the, in a certain way, the precursors, evolutionary precursors. So the human did not come out of nothing. Yeah? But it developed transimmanent in a certain way as a higher step in the Entwicklungsstufe and Entwicklungsgeschichte, as we say, because Entwicklung is really the Sanskrit word. Yeah? It is really the unfolding of the threat. So it's a thread that is unfolded, first it is folded, involved in the primary matter, and then it unfolds the thread in a certain way in the vertical direction. Yeah? And it entwickelt sich, and step by step, Stufe für Stufe. And this is the self-constitution of the self. Yeah? Yeah. And it's become.
I looked a little bit to the Taittiriya Upanishad and let me say a few remarks on the context of the passage. The very context of the passage is how the human with his soul, with his little soul, with his Atman can relate to the great world soul of the Brahman, of the transcendence soul of everything. And they said, you shall meditate on Brahman as a food. This is the anamaya, you would say anamaya kosha, but there is, and then they say, you shall meditate, they say upasate, like make upasana, on Brahma as a prana. You shall see the Brahman as a vijnana or as ananda, as a bliss. And so there's no, in the original Taittiriya Upanishad, there's no hierarchical orders of it. This is just an explanation how one can relate and meditate on Brahma, how one can reach Brahma. And to make the system out of it is perhaps the later development, perhaps some kind of Aurobindo invention to read into it some systematics. But the original context of the Taittiriya Upanishad is just to tell how to meditate on Brahma. So there's not so much of hierarchical order to reach the higher plane. You can just find it in yourself and to meditate about Brahma like knowledge, like vijnana, or to meditate about Brahma like bliss, like ananda, or to meditate about Brahma like food, all those planes. So this is one remark. And the other remark is, the whole passage starts with the elements. You perhaps mentioned it with the physical plane as it's very connected to the elements of earth. So this is another context of this passage. It's it starts about the elements, like the Vijnana, for example, is the element of fire, and the Ananda is of ether, and etc. So those two remarks I only just wanted to say when I look at the Taittiriya Upanishad as a passage.
Kena. Yes, I would absolutely agree. Of course, we would only philosophically now. You know, where is the difference between the philological and the philosophical? The philosophical, you use the word, for example, meditation. As a philosopher, I again have to wonder by not knowing what they mean with meditation. Yeah? So what does meditation mean in this context? Now, I would say, yes, I would agree with everything what you said. So the first thing, it is discovering the self, yeah? So that is the purpose. And through meditating on all these layers which are constitutive for this self. Yeah, this is how I would translate it philosophically, in a philosophical language of the thing. So it's exactly what you are saying, meditation. What does meditation in this context mean? So is this now a subject, as we would usually today understand meditation? So a person is standing here in a very Western way. An individual is standing here in order to meditate as a subject on what is the self or the Brahman. Yeah? What is that self? And philosophically, for me, there are such a lot of Western concepts mixed philosophically when I have this image, what I said right now. So meditation is a subjective individual practice. As a philosopher, I would strongly question this, that we have the image that somebody is sitting there meditating. So for example, what I always bring here together is that exactly in many traditions, and we have not just our Bindu, the other strongly resist, for example, we have the whole Tattva system in Chamkya Yoga of 25 principles, we have it in Tantrism of the 36 principles of the Tattvas, and they are strongly connected for me in a certain way to this. So I wrote, this is not just what there was Upanishad and then there was Aurobindo, but this was a long tradition which in a certain way, of course, was also translated in a certain way. But it was picked up by a lot of Indian traditions which in a certain way tried to understand it. So the first thing would be, what do we mean when we meditate? Is this now a subjective behavior of individuals? Or as, for example, Deleuze would say, is this a process of desubjectivation? Yeah? Is this a way of getting rid exactly of my so-called individual personal view on these things? So in my personal view, I usually would not identify with Brahman. Yeah? So the whole form of meditation for me is from a process to get rid of exactly these concepts in which I identify with my subjective individual body and where I do not identify with all these cosmic layers, yeah, which they are, or cosmic principles which they are in. So that would be my answer. So it's very difficult to understand what here in this context meditation or means. But I'm absolutely with you. By reflecting and going through these sheets and layers, you know, of vijnana, of knowledge, of bliss, yeah, of mind, yeah, of the vital, after the thought, as you said, expansion. So when I go in an with my awareness, that would be my turn. So if I go with my awareness through this lane, I in certain way do research about myself, about my Atman. And so by the meditation through these layers, I learn to know myself. Yeah? But this myself, which is now at the disposition here, is not at all the self that identifies with its, with the mirror, as I would say, with the mirror picture which we see in a mirror. Yeah? This is the self that I see in the mirror. This is exactly from where we want to, this narcissistic picture of myself, I want to get rid through the praxis, get rid of through the praxis of the meditation. So that would, but in what you said, I would absolutely agree. So the question would only be what the word meditation here means and how we do understand meditation. And the other thing I think not right, because if I think of the tantric philosophies, they pick up these whole ideas of the tattvas and of the layers in a certain way. So we find this in many traditions of Indian philosophy.
Yes, I only want to say in Taittiriya Upanishad there is no kosha.